I have in front of me Dr. Stuart Ross Taylor, who was involved with NASA's Lunar Sample Analysis Program and the Chemical Analysis section of the Lunar Receiving Laboratory in Houston. He's going to tell us something about his experiences after Apollo 11. Now, Dr. Taylor, Harold Urey was one of the first driving forces to initiate the Apollo moon missions. Did the missions bring home the results that Urey had hoped for?
Well, not exactly. Harold Urey had expected that the moon was a primitive object left over from the very beginning of the solar system, and he figured out that by going to it we would be able to look at this very primitive object and work out what had happened at the beginning of the solar system. It turned out, of course, the moon was a highly complicated object with a geological history of its own, and that somewhat ironically it did provide us with keys to what went on in the early history of the solar system, mainly for by highlighting the importance of collisions, large collisions of meteorites and asteroids with the moon, but certainly not in the way that Harold had envisaged.
Are all the scientists in agreement with the results?
Yes, it's fair to say there's a consensus view now on the origin and evolutionary history of the moon from from the results from the Apollo missions. And the reason for this is that all the other alternative theories have pretty much been demolished.
Is it true that we know more about lunar rocks than some terrestrial counterparts?
Yes, it again, there's a certain irony in this, that I think we understand the both the origin and evolution of the moon more clearly than we do that of the Earth, partly because, of course, the Earth is a much bigger object, and we are still uncertain about quite a lot of the details of the interior of the Earth. The moon is very much smaller. It's only 1/80th of the mass of the Earth, and it had a very much simpler history, and for these sort of reasons, we have a very much clearer view of the history and origin of the moon.
Can you comment on the statement, "Never in the field of human endeavour was so much discovered by so few from so little"?
Well, yes, this goes back to Churchill's famous comment in the Battle of Britain, but it's certainly interesting in that it took, or has taken, 200-300 years of geological exploration of the Earth to sort out what has happened. It's only in the last 20 or 25 years that we understood, for example, that plate tectonics was operating in the Earth, and this was the result of an immense effort by generations of geologists and geophysicists, whereas on the moon we had it sorted out in about a decade.
Have there been any common events found that could be connected between the moon and the Earth?
Well, yes, in the sense that there are meteorite impacts on both bodies. And on the Earth, of course, the evidence for these events is pretty much wiped out by erosion and weathering and so on of rocks. And so the evidence for these large impacts was very hard to find on the Earth and was doubted for many years by geologists. Whereas on the moon, of course, the moon is covered with craters. There'd be no atmosphere, no weathering. If a crater forms on the moon by an impact, it stays there until it's wiped out by another impact. On the Earth, of course, these things are eroded away. So for many years, geologists doubted that there were such things as large meteorite impacts on the Earth, but now the evidence has become quite clear. We see the remnants of old craters and so on. So this is perhaps one of the major, perhaps one of the few things that the Earth and the Moon have in common geologically.
The Moon is riddled with rills. Are these tunnels that have collapsed?
Well, they caused a lot of questions. Here were these channels looking a little bit like river channels. They were obviously had been cut by some kind of fluid, and so people thought this was evidence for water on the moon. However, it turned out that these are channels cut by lavas, and they're really quite big. Hadley Rill, close to Apollo 15, is about a kilometre across, and these are much larger than lava channels on the Earth. And the reason for this is that the lavas are very much more fluid than on the Earth, because they turn out to have a much higher iron content. So they have the viscosity of about engine oil. They flow very easily compared to the more viscous lavas on the Earth, which are more like toffee. So these lunar lavas have the properties, if you like, almost close to that of water, and they're able to cut these channels. They're probably open channels. It'd be very difficult to roof over something a kilometre or so in wood. So the feeling is that they probably were always open, or perhaps had a skin of lava over the top. We still don't have a complete answer to this question.
Does the moon have a solid or a molten core? Do we know anything about the core of the moon?
It's unfortunate that we didn't have a decent meteorite impact on the far side of the moon. There was one large one, which we might discuss later. But in order to give us a seismic signals which we could map the centre of the moon properly, it turns out that the centre of the moon is possibly liquid, but we don't really know that. There's almost certainly a small iron core of perhaps about 200 or 300 kilometres, about 2% of the mass of the moon, a very small core in the centre. And but that remains one of the sort of uncertain areas which we would hope to find out about in future missions.
The Apollo missions left a number of AlSVEPs on the moon, among which the experiments that they used was seismic activity. Can you tell us some of the results of the seismic activity from the Apollo AlSVEPs?
Well, they detected a series of small moonquakes, very low intensity quakes, and most of these repeated on a sort of monthly cycle as the moon rotated around the Earth. And it seemed to be these were just sort of basically creaking and groaning of the moon, if you like, stresses involved, tidal stresses in the moon due to its rotation, not due to internal processes as we have on the Earth with earthquakes. They were just sort of tidally induced stresses on the moon. The AlSVEP did, of course, pick up the impact of a large meteorite on about a one-ton object on the far side in 1972, which gave us some information about the interior of the moon.
On the tracking stations, we would see the surface cracking and moving at sunrise as the temperature rose and the sunlight crept across the dust and the lunar surface. How deep did this activity go?
Well, I think probably only a few centimetres at most. Of course, the surface is covered with a layer of rubble anywhere from 2 or 3 perhaps to 8 or 10 metres deep of ground up, smashed up rock and boulders and fine soil, all continuously being reworked by meteorite impact. And this is the so-called regolith or layer of soil, and this acts as an insulating blanket over the surface. And any effects, temperature effect, would be only in the upper few centimetres.
Okay. Can you explain why the moon rings like a bell? We used to hear quite a bit during the days of Apollo when they used to crash the LEM onto the surface, and we used to hear that they saw the moon ring like a bell. Can you describe that?
Yes, well, the seismometers picked this up. This was one of the extraordinary things, that when you had the impact of these objects on the moon would continue, unlike a terrestrial earthquake which dies away, damped out quite quickly. These shock waves, if you like, would continue to reverberate around the moon for like periods of like an hour or more. This is attributed to the extremely dry nature of the lunar rocks, that there's no moisture on the moon and nothing to sort of damp out the damp out these vibrations. And the moon is the surface, particularly, of course, is covered with rubble, and this just transmits these waves without them being damped out in any way as they are on the Earth. So they just ran round and round the moon, basically. And so that led to this idea that the moon was ringing. And it's a consequence of the moon being extremely dry.
Now, we had Apollo 11 through to Apollo 17. Did we change our experimental attitudes much between 11 and 17? In other words, did we learn much from 11 to incorporate into the future experiments?
Well, yes, because a lot of what came back from Apollo 11 was unexpected, or at least there were many different schools of thought about what we were going to find on the moon, in particular the age of the lunar surface and the composition of the rocks, and there were a large number of surprises from the initial Apollo 11 mission about the composition of the rocks and the age of the rocks, and this then pretty much wiped out a lot of the pre-Apollo speculation and led us to focus in on quite new directions on what had happened to the moon. For example, it had not been really conceived that the moon might have been molten early in its history, and yet this was one of the things that came out of the early work. And so we had to reorient our thinking really quite dramatically. There's nothing like a few hard facts to come back to really dispose of a lot of wishful thinking.
Were there any useful minerals found?
Well, it depends on your definition of useful, of course, but there are, of course, refractory minerals, and there's quite a lot of feldspar, a lot of titanium oxides, elements like this, but none of these would be particularly useful economically on the Earth. I mean, they're very common elements. It's ironic that the elements we think of as precious or rare, like the platinum group elements, lead, silver, gold, these sort of elements, are all in very low abundance on the moon, which is partly a consequence of the way the moon originated and its subsequent history. But there's a certain irony in this that, for example, some people thought the moon's surface might be covered with diamonds because there would be carbon there and the meteorite impacts, the high pressures would produce diamonds, but unfortunately there's no carbon. So that the almost everything we think of as an ore mineral, in fact, is missing on the moon. There is one thing which is present, is helium-3, which is comes from the solar wind, which could be a mineable resource, because helium-3 would be very useful as a fuel for fusion reactors on the Earth.
Was there any sign of moisture on the moon?
We didn't find a drop. The moon's dry as a bone. There is a feeling that there might be in some of the craters at the South Pole, which are in permanent shadow, there might be ice there, perhaps as a result of cometary impacts. But the moon itself had no water on the surface, no water in the rocks, no bound up hydroxyl ions in the minerals. All the minerals are anhydrous. Unlike in the Earth, where we have many minerals which have water or hydroxyl ions in their structure.
What was the reaction when lunar soil came in contact with terrestrial water?
Well, none that I'm aware of, except that it had it leached out in the lunar soil. There are quite a lot of small glassy fragments from the meteorite impact and so on, and these tend to contain elements. The small amounts of potassium on the moon are in these glasses, and these are rather already leached out by the water, and so it made the lunar soil sort of quite fertile for things to grow in.
Dr. Taylor, what were the results of the trials growing terrestrial plants in lunar soil?
Well, they were really quite spectacular at first, and this caused a lot of interest in the lunar receiving lab. And the reason for this was that they were, as I said, the potassium was leached out rather easily from the glass in the soil, so the plants grew quite well in it. But their control, when we checked what these botanists were doing, their control soils were quartz sand. And, of course, quartz sand is a pretty barren medium for things to grow in. So the lunar soil plants growing in the lunar soil did much better than the plants growing in the quartz sand. It looks like the moon was enriched. It would be a great thing to grow plants on, but the experiment really was not very well controlled.
Can you explain why lunar rocks are much older than terrestrial rocks?
Well, yes, because the geological history of the moon started right back when the moon was formed. The moon was melted and it crystallized and formed a crust, and lavas came up from the interior. All this happening about 3 to 4 billion years ago, and then the moon shut down. So that most of the rocks on the moon are significantly older than rocks on the Earth. The Earth, of course, goes through many cycles of erosion, and material is removed and recycled back into the mantle. So there's a cyclical process going on the Earth, which is not going on in the moon. So the net result is most of the rocks we see on the Earth tend to be young, very much younger than those that we see on the moon.
Dr. Taylor, from what you've told us, it seems there's not very much on the moon to support life. Can you comment on that, please?
Yes, the basic problem, of course, is total lack of an atmosphere, lack of any oxygen, but there's also, of course, a lack of carbon in the soil. There's nothing to build life from, as we know it, and, of course, the surface is exposed to extremes of heat and cold, and hard vacuum, much better vacuum than we can get in a terrestrial laboratory, and also, of course, the absence of water assists in this. And the other problem, of course, is that it's directly exposed to solar radiation, so that as all the ultraviolet radiation from the sun is falling directly in the surface. So it's almost an ideal, if you like, sterile environment.
It was thought that the spacecraft might be swallowed up by a talcum-like dust. Do you think there are any pockets of deep dust bowls such as this?
No. There's on the surface, there's this layer of rubble, which is anything from boulder size down to quite micron-sized particles, which have been smashed up by the meteorite impact, and there's quite a lot of fine dust in this, mixed in with this. But the idea, of course, went back to Tommy Gold, who has suggested that the lunar maria were in fact gigantic dust bowls filled up with dust from the craters in the lunar highlands, and that these were perhaps 2 or 3 kilometres deep, and any spacecraft landing on the moon would sink straight through these, and it cost the American taxpayers a lot of money. They had to set up the surveyor missions to establish the bearing strength of the surface, and the surveyors, of course, had a little shovel device on them to scrape away at the surface, and the cameras to look at the landing pads, and of course they found that the bearing strength of the surface was about the same as that of a sandy beach, so that the spacecraft would only sink in a few inches.
So what are the highest and lowest temperatures recorded in the moon surface?
Well, at the Apollo sites, the maximum temperatures were up to about 110 centigrade, which is above the boiling point of water, of course, and the coldest temperatures down to minus 170 centigrade. So there are extremes of temperature, and this, of course, in the absence of an atmosphere and convection, if one side of an object is illuminated by the sun, it will be hot, and the other side in the shade will be freezing cold. And this led to the reason for wrapping the legs of the landing spacecraft lander with gold to get good conduction of heat from one side to the other, so to avoid thermal stresses on the landing legs.
Now, are we any closer to finding out where the moon came from after the Apollo missions?
Well, yes. One of the, of course, reasons that Harold Urey had said we're going to find out about the origin of the moon and the origin of the solar system by going there, and by about 1974, 1984, about 20 years after the landings, very little progress had been made on the question of the origin of the moon, and it became a little embarrassing. People would ask us, well, you've had now 20 years to work on these samples, surely you can answer the question where the moon came from. And people had been really very busy working on the detail of the chemistry and the ages and all the other scientific investigations. And to some extent, the origin of the moon had been put in the too hard box, because all the pre-Apollo theories of capture, fission and double planet ideas collapsed with the lunar data. None of the Apollo data fitted any of these preconceived theories. And it wasn't until about 1984 that a conference was held in Hawaii. It was thought of at this time we'd better have a conference to sort out this problem. You know, when you have an unsolved problem, you have a conference. and then they thought, well, since because of the old idea that the moon came out of the Pacific Ocean, an idea going back to George Darwin, it might be some special insight might be gained by holding the conference in Hawaii in the centre of the Pacific Ocean. and so we held it there. And in fact, we did get some special insight. And this was the idea that the moon had originated as a result of a glancing impact of some body the size of Mars that had hit the Earth in the very early days, just as the Earth and the Moon, as the Earth and the other planets were forming. A lot of large collisions were appearing, and we happened to have this chance collision with this Mars-sized object, which spun out the mantle, the rocky mantle of the impacting object, which spun out to form the Moon. And this explained a whole host of observations. First of all, why the Earth-Moon system is spinning rapidly. Something had given it a very large kick. And the other reason why the Moon is rocky and the Earth is much denser, and the strange orbit of the Moon, and of course the chemistry as well.
Well, while on that subject, I presume you've found nothing to support Velikovsky's theory of a passing planet upsetting the Earth's equilibrium.
No, there have been some computers designed to look at the long-term stability of the solar system. And these are called orreries after the mechanical models, the orreries, which are the mechanical models of the solar system built a couple of hundred years ago. And these are computer versions of these, looking at the long-term stability. And it seems from this that there's no sign that the present arrangement of the planets has changed over the past four and a half billion years since the solar system settled down into its present arrangement.
Has there ever been any volcanism on the moon?
Yes, well, there's quite a lot of volcanism, but not exactly in the sense we understand it in the Earth, in that you don't get Fujiyama-type volcanoes on the moon. You get the dark patches on the moon that form the features of the man of the moon are actually lava flows. But as I said earlier, they're extremely fluid, so they flood out over the surface, filling up all the hollows. They come up, they melt in the interior, they come up as lavas do on the Earth, and then they just flow widely over the surface because they're so fluid. And so they cover very large areas, but they're mostly flat lava plains. And we have examples of this on the Earth, but the conventional sort of feeling about that you have a central volcano like Hawaii or Fujiyama or Mount Helens, these volcanoes don't exist on the moon. And the large craters we see are all due to meteorite impact.
Okay. What was the age of the oldest sample that Apollo brought back?
Of course, there's been a little bit of debate about this. Measuring the ages is quite a difficult procedure to do, which is why you really have to do it in a terrestrial laboratory. The oldest, I think, genuine age is 4,440 million years, with an error of about 20 million years on it. And this is the age of the white lunar highland crust, and this is only about 100 million years after the formation of the solar system. So you had to do quite a lot of things in a fairly brief period of time. You had to, by that in that period formed the Earth and formed the Moon, and the Moon, within 100 million years after the formation of the solar system, was looking pretty much as it does today.
How does this compare with the age of the Earth's surface?
Well, the oldest rocks we have on the Earth are about just under 4,000 million or 4 billion years old. And these are very tiny remnants of rocks in the Northwest Territories of Canada. As I say, most of the rocks on the Earth's surface have been eroded. The old rocks have been eroded away. There obviously were rocks present at that time, but most of these have disappeared through erosion and recycling. So the Moon gives us a unique sort of window into the early solar system.
So when you say recycling, you mean going back in under the mantle?
Going back into the mantle or just being destroyed by erosion and so on. Yeah.
There's a displacement of the crust of the Moon towards the Earth. Can you describe to us what caused this displacement and how the lunar mountains came to be formed?
Yes, there's one of these features which have been known for a very long time. A lot of these dynamical things have been known for 100 years or more, that the centre of mass of the Moon is displaced towards the Earth by about a couple of kilometres relative to the geometrical centre of the Moon. If you work out where the geometrical centre is, the centre of the mass of the Moon is displaced a little bit towards the Earth. And the reason for this seems to be that the crust of the Moon, which is about 60 kilometres thick on the near side, is this white. The white area you see on the Moon is this so-called Highland crust. It's basically feldspar, which is why it's white. And on the far side, it's about 100 or perhaps even a bit 100 kilometres or a bit thicker. And it's rather low-density material, so basically the Moon has an excess of low-density material on the far side, and that means that the centre of mass is actually displaced a little bit towards the Earth, and it's locked in, obviously for that reason, I suppose, as the Moon rotates around the Earth, the centre of mass has been is pulled a little bit towards the Earth. With respect to the mountains, which of course puzzled people from the earliest telescope observations, one of the striking features is that you get circular arcs of mountains, quite high mountains, up to 20,000 feet, and the fact that these mountains tended to lie along the arcs of circles puzzled people. And then, of course, around the impact craters you have quite substantial peaks as well, and sometimes central peaks inside the impact basins, which are due to rebound after the meteorite hit. But the big circular mountains, the Carpathians and so on, are in fact the result of asteroidal impact of objects perhaps 50 or 100 kilometres in diameter hitting the Moon, and it's a bit like dropping a stone in a pond. The rocks behave fluidly, and as the meteorite hits, you get these ripples, a series of waves out, and these effectively freeze as the mountain ridges, and these are often 2 or 3 kilometres high, so that these great structures, which are one of these big circular structures is the size of France, with several circular rings of mountains around it, and it's formed in probably 5 minutes.
Oh, big mountains like that.
No, just like dropping a stone in a pond.
Right. Yeah. Now, just a thought occurred to me. As the Moon always faces one surface towards the Earth, as the Earth spins around, would there be one side of the Moon receive more impact craters than the other side? In other words, the side facing outwards would receive more than the inside?
Has been a relatively recent locking of the Moon and the Earth together. Well, since the time when we had the very large impact flux, of course, was back right at the beginning when probably the Moon was still rotating relative to the Earth. But I think, in fact, there's
There was a point where the Earth and the Moon... were rotating separately.
Well, I would that would at the beginning this would have been would have been so, but this was of course in the very early stages. But the I think no, the meteorite impacts come in pretty much randomly, and
How did the samples brought back from the moon compare with the Surveyor results, particularly Apollo 12 and Surveyor 3?
Well, yes, Apollo 12, of course, landed within a few hundred metres of Surveyor 3, which was a really a great technical feat in the navigation.
600 feet.
600 feet, yes. Okay. It was certainly a... it was a remarkable technical feat since Apollo 11 had been off course by 4 miles or so. And the Surveyor 3 had a chemical analysis equipment on board, which had signaled back that they were sitting on something looking like a basaltic lava, but rather high in titanium, and people didn't tend to believe this result. But when we got the first analysis from the lunar samples, it showed that, in fact, that they were high in titanium, and this vindicated the Surveyor 3 analysis, which had been about which had been some scepticism. Mm.
So as a scientist, you strongly support obtaining samples as against sending a remote sensing device to analyse soils of other bodies?
Well, yes, in spite of what I've just said about the relative accuracy of the Surveyor 3 analytical equipment, you can certainly obtain sort of rough surface analyses, and you can do this for major elements, but if you want to look at either the trace element contents or the isotopic abundances or the age determinations in particular, you really have to get a sample back into terrestrial laboratory. It's quite difficult to do the analysis here, and it's not that you can't design the equipment. The equipment, you can make beautiful mass spectrometers and equipment to work in these services, but the real trouble is not so much the equipment, but it's what sample you put in, and you've got no control basically over what you put into these into this equipment. We saw this on Mars with the Viking lander, where there were three experiments designed to detect biological activity or life, and they returned very enigmatic results.
They were inconclusive.
You see, either you get the result you expect, or else you get something you can't interpret. And obviously what seems to have happened to Mars is that the soil was quite strongly oxidizing and this gave a simulated effect of life. The real conclusive experiment on the Viking lander was a mass spectrometer which found no trace of carbon, so that there was no real possibility of having a carbon-based life present. And the biological experiments were so... unexpected that we couldn't really interpret them. And that's the problem with remote sensing. Mm.
Do you feel that the samples brought back cover the lunar soil in general, or do you feel that there are areas that may be older examples or materials that we haven't thought of there?
Well, the moon is fortunately a lot simpler than the Earth, and people often say if you brought back a sample from the Earth, if you landed in six places on the Earth, you couldn't possibly work out the geological history of the Earth from six random sites. But on the Moon, of course, we have a much clearer view because we don't have the oceans, we don't have the soil cover, and we have very good photography over the surface. And there are probably some areas of lava flows which may be a little younger than the ones we sampled. So there are these sorts of minor problems, but I think basically we already have a very good idea of the overall composition of the lunar surface and the ages and so on. Of course, it would be very nice to have extra data on these. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of second order questions which could be asked, but I think the first order question has in fact been answered.
Right. With no atmosphere and weather, would the material on top of mountains be the same as the material in the bottom of valleys?
More or less. There's not much a way of moving material down slope, except during large impacts where stuff is thrown around. And there are examples, for example, on the moon of boulders which have rolled downhill, probably due to shaking of the moon by large impact. It's just lodged some of the large boulders that Jack Schmidt looked at Apollo 17 had come down the hillside, hundreds of kilometres away from Tycho, the big impact crater. There was a probable landslide caused at the Apollo 17 site by one of the big boulders thrown out from Tycho hitting the top of the hill causing a landslide into the valley. So there's a certain amount of this goes on, but nothing like the general erosion that goes on all the time on the Earth.
Well, you mentioned Tycho there. I suppose cratering has been taking place almost since the formation of the Moon. Is it true that Copernicus and Tycho ring craters were formed more recently?
Yes, they are much younger. In fact, Copernicus is used as one of the time markers on the Moon, and it formed probably about a billion years ago, very much later than the big bombardment responsible for most of the big lunar craters in the Highland, which ceased about over 4 billion years ago. Copernicus is only about 1 billion years old. Tycho is probably only about much younger than that, only about 100 million years old. So that would be during the Jurassic period on the Earth. And it's interesting that Tycho, of course, is the last big lunar crater. It's about 95 kilometres in diameter, and it must have been formed by something at least 10 kilometres in diameter hitting the Moon. And, of course, it gives a spectacular rays over the Moon that you can see through field glasses. So it's a very spectacular event, and rays from the Tycho explosion were thrown right around the Moon. It's interesting, of course, that this is not that far away in time from the impact in the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary on the Earth about 65 million years ago, that this is the one that probably did in the dinosaurs, and that was probably a 10-kilometre object hitting the Earth. So there are these objects floating around, although fortunately they don't hit us very often.
Yes, we'd know all about it, wouldn't we?
That's right, yes, indeed, yes.
When did scientists find that tektites no longer came from the Moon? Because I remember we used to talk quite a bit about tektites before Apollo. We had quite a few in Australia, and I can remember there was a little exercise to go and find them in the desert.
Well, it's fair to say there was a raging controversy about tektites right through the 60s, in which I was heavily involved, and I still have a number of scars on me from those arguments, because I was on the terrestrial side of the fence. But it was a battle fought with great ferocity, and particularly since we knew the lunar samples were coming back, and the first sample analysis I think was sufficient to dispose of the hypothesis that tektites came from the Moon. As one of my colleagues said, that the lunar origin of tektites, which had been a stimulating hypothesis for 75 years, died on July the 20th, 1969, from a massive overdose of lunar data.
All right. So what effect, if any, does the solar wind have on the lunar surface?
Of course, it impinges almost directly on the Moon, there being no atmosphere, no magnetic field on the Moon, so the solar wind comes straight in and impacts on the surface. Except, of course, when the Moon is shielded by the Earth's magnetosphere. But the lunar soil soaks up quite large quantities of hydrogen and helium and rare gases from the solar wind. And this was one of the surprises of the Apollo mission. When the rare gas people got hold of the samples, they found these soils sitting on the surface had very large amounts of hydrogen, helium, and so on in them, and other rare gases. And this was somewhat of a surprise.
Hmm. Why is the Moon evenly bright when viewed from the Earth over the whole sphere?
Well, this is one of the old ancient puzzles about the Moon, because if you have a smooth sphere and you illuminate it, you know that it's going to be bright in the middle and darker towards the edges. And
the Earth's like that, isn't it?
The Earth's like that. Mm. And so that when you look at the Moon, here it is, it could almost be a flat plate in the sky, because it's bright right across. And the reason for this, of course, is that it's covered with rubble from these impacts, and there are multitudes of sort of reflectors, a bit like the reflectors on a bicycle. There are all sorts of crystals and rocks and boulders and angles cut right across the surface, looking sort of, and you can find enough of them which will be looking directly back at the Earth, so that you get this even illumination right across the surface. And this was, it was figured out that the moon must have rubble on it, around about in the late 50s, I think. One of the people working this was the late Professor Jager at the Research School of Earth Sciences at ANU, who was one of the people working on this. This is the sort of problem you could work on at that time.
Two questions about the lunar soil. Would it have a smell?
Not to my knowledge, and I certainly have handled plenty of it, but I suspect there's nothing in it to give rise to a smell, and it is totally dry and there's no organic material. Whereas on the Earth, I think the smell is mainly comes from the volatile organic materials or molecules which our nose, because it's very sensitive at picking up.
You see, the astronauts mentioned the smell when they climbed into the lens.
Yes, I've got no experience in that, really.
So you think they might have smelt something from the descent engine gases or something inside the lunar?
It's possible, yes. Mm.
It wouldn't be any interaction with the oxygen of the interior of the limb?
No, I don't know. There was none, fortunately. Mm. Yeah.
If a lunar soil came near water, being so dry, or not necessarily water, but something that had moisture on it, it would tend to leap up to grab the moisture? Would that be a...
Well, it was interesting, and it was so dry that it had this static charge on it, and so that you could put the lunar soil into a vial, a small vial, and you could tip the vial upside down, it wouldn't fall out, because it would stick there. But this was because it was of the static charge in this extremely dry material.
Can you tell us something about the MASCONs, which affected a lot of the missions around the
moon? This was a again one of these unexpected things discovered on the moon, and these are variations in the density of the near lunar surface, and of course this affected the trajectory of the spacecraft, and one of the reasons that Apollo 11 came down off course the trajectory was being affected by these variations in the gravity field. And these, of course, occur over the dark patches of the moon, which are the so-called lunar maria, the dark circular patches, where you get lava which has come up and filled these large basins. So you get mass concentrations near surface. One of the causes of the MASCONs are the loading on the surface by these lava flows, filling these large impact basins. The other one is that when these big impact basins form, these things which are the size of France, they're formed by these perhaps 100-kilometer object hitting the moon, and this the effect of a large blow from above, an explosion, is that you get a rebound effect, and part of the more denser lunar mantle rises up towards the surface. You get a sort of a... In fact, some of the craters, you get a central peak resulting from this. In the case of the large basins, you get this central core of denser material has risen up, and this plus the lava which has flooded into the basin, it causes a excess gravity field localized over this basin, and this of course distorts the orbit of the spacecraft.
So the MASCON itself, which is a heavier material than the...
It's
composed of what?
A combination of lava and the lunar mantle material, which has come up into the lighter
greater
crust.
Mass.
Yes, give you a greater mass. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Taylor, did Australia gain anything from the lunar sample analysis?
Well, it, of course, gained a certain amount of scientific prestige by the fact that there were several lunar sample investigators working on the samples. mostly at the ANU, and we of course went to the conferences in Houston, and our results were well received by our colleagues, and so we achieved quite a high scientific visibility, and of course it had the effect of stimulating the scientific work, and when you're in direct competition with people from all over the world and everyone has the same sample, there's a certain premium on coming with the correct answer. And in fact there was quite a shakeout, of course, of scientific investigators around the world between the ones who got the right answers and the ones who didn't. Because a lot of this work was really quite difficult. So it had, I think, very beneficial effects in that way, in terms of upgrading both the status of the laboratories at the ANU and generally exposing us to the international scientific scene.
So 25 years down the track, it was a lucky break that we got involved with this.
Oh yes, I think it seems to me that any country which had any pretensions to being scientifically literate and so on really had a responsibility to get involved in this program. It was a unique opportunity, and as I say, we did make I think all the investigators made significant contributions to the, and when we, at one point I went back checking on the initial the fates of the initial investigators and so on, and about a third of them made significant advances in our knowledge, which shows how difficult it is to pick people in advance.
Dr. Taylor, are we still working on the analysis of the lunar samples?
Well, there is quite a body of people still working, mostly in America, on the samples, and there's a little bit of work going on still in Australia, and of course a lot of related work on meteorites and the early solar system. And what has happened really is that this has blossomed out into because of the results from Voyager and the other space missions as well, this has blossomed out into a whole sort of investigation of the solar system, and which the moon is really a key issue, because we have the samples and we have the dates from this, which we don't have, of course, from any other planetary body, except we do have some meteorite samples from Mars, which are, of course, also being interpreted in the light of what we learned on the moon. So the moon was really acted as a sort of a Rosetta Stone in this, and this has opened up. Say personally, I'm now working on basically models for the origin of the solar system and the planets and the satellites in general. So what started off with lunar work has now expanded out into a whole investigation of the solar system, and this shows up at the annual conferences we have in Houston, where now perhaps only 10% of the meeting is devoted to lunar samples and the rest is devoted to the rest of the solar system.
How do we get the micrometeorites from Mars?
They're actually chunks of rock. They're fist-sized chunks of rock. So they're proper meteorites. And these have been knocked off Mars by meteorite collisions with Mars.
Enough to overcome the gravity of Mars?
Enough to, yes. There was a lot of discussion to begin with, and some theoreticians said it was impossible to get them off Mars without destroying them because of the shock pressure. But it turns out, of course, when you do this, when you hit Mars and blow a crater, some of the rocks get thrown off, which are not particularly shocked. Some of the rocks on the edge get into Earth-crossing orbit. These, of course, were... these samples have been known on the Earth as meteorites for quite a long time, and they were known to be somewhat funny in comparison with the other meteorites. Mostly they were quite a lot younger, and the thing which was the definitive piece of evidence was that they contained some trapped gases which matched the atmospheric gas compositions recorded on the Viking landers on Mars. There are a number of the rare gases.
Is this how we identified that they came from Mars?
Yeah, this was the decisive bit of evidence. There were a lot of circumstantial evidence, but the fact that the the rare gases, neon, krypton, xenon, their isotopic compositions matched what the Viking lander had measured on Mars. And it's unlike the Earth atmosphere. And so this was the decisive bit of evidence.
Now, where were they found?
Some in Antarctica, but some had been found scattered over the Earth and were known to be somewhat strange meteorites.
Hmm.
But they'd been, some of them have been in the collections for a long time. And of course then we've also found subsequently from Antarctica about half a dozen meteorites from the moon and one in Western Australia. And these are now identified, of course, since we have the lunar samples. We can identify them as lunar and not... otherwise, we would again have a mystery. So,
yes, fascinating. Hmm. Now, turning to Apollo 11, can you describe the moments after the astronauts first returned to the interior of the LEM and your concern about the safety of the astronauts from gases or heating effects of the lunar soil coming in contact with the pure oxygen?
Well, we'd had some discussions about this before the mission, and the question had been raised that since the material on the moon was in a hard vacuum, there would be lots of reduced, lots of metallic iron, probably fine-grained, lying about on the surface. And everyone knew, of course, if you take some iron filings, and this is a high school chemistry experiment, you take iron filings and put them in an oxygen atmosphere and they burst into flame just from the extremely rapid oxidation of the iron. And so this had been raised as a possible hazard to the astronauts, and of course the samples were supposed to be in the lunar, sealed up in a box, but of course dust, although we didn't quite know that at the time, dust got everywhere on the astronauts' clothes the interior of the LEM was coated with dust. It just stuck on everywhere. So when the I was watching in Houston the big screen with the account with the lunar Apollo 11 landing being transmitted on it, and finally they got back in and shut up the LEM, and the we sat there in silence and waited and. For some minutes, it seemed like a very long time, and nothing came through. And finally, Mission Control called up and started calling Tranquility Base, the first time there was no answer, and they called a couple of times, and you could hear from the controller's voice. I thought there was a certain amount of tension. I thought, well, I hope that these lunar samples were not ignited in the pure oxygen atmosphere when they pressurized the LEM. And so I thought, sat through a rather bad 5 minutes thinking this, and finally they came in the air, and of course what they'd been doing was pressurizing them, then getting out of their suits and so on. So there was this gap of time in which there was no communication, but I thought for a little time maybe that's what had happened, and a couple of my colleagues looked at one another wondering whether this in fact is what had gone on.
Hmm. Now, the Lunar Receiving Laboratory in Houston, could you describe how you came to be involved in it and what happened?
Well, it's, I guess, like everything in life, it's a certain amount of serendipity and chances which lead to this. But I grew up in New Zealand and did chemistry at the university, and about halfway through my career as a student I discovered geology, and this was so fascinating I decided to become a geologist. And so eventually I put these two subjects together into what was then a new subject called geochemistry, which was the chemistry of rocks and minerals. And I went off to work with another New Zealander who had gone to Indiana University. And he started me working on spectrographic methods of analysis, which were analysis of trace. It was the standard technique of analysing trace elements in rocks and minerals. And then I went from there, I went to Oxford, where I met a South African colleague who had written the definitive textbook on the subject, and he asked me to help him do a second edition on this technique, and which was really a great chance for someone who was 30 years old at that point. And so as a result of this, I became quite well known in this field of trace element analysis using spectrographic techniques. And when they were setting up the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, they decided to put one of these instruments in the laboratory because it was the quick way of getting a... You could work with a few milligrams of sample, you could get analysis for 70 or 80 elements, all elements were potentially detectable on a few milligrams of sample, and this was perhaps the thought that this was all that would come back. And I happened to be in the States early in 69 at a conference on tektites, which we were having one of these ding-dong battles about lunar versus terrestrial. In fact, at the conference, we took a vote. This was in March 69, and my colleague, the person who'd done my PhD with, this New Zealander, Brian Mason, who's a meteorite expert, he was the chairman. He asked call for a vote, and it was 50-50 on whether the tektites came from the Earth or the Moon. This is 3 or 4 months before the mission. So we... So then I went down to Houston, where another Australian, Robin Brett, was the chief geochemist there. It's interesting, a large number of people from what had been the British Empire, if you like, were involved in the Apollo missions. The place was full of them. Mm. And the Australians, I was in New Zealand, and there were quite a lot of people from England and so on. Anyway, Robin... said, well, we've got this spectrographic laboratory running here and we're having troubles with it. And he said, I really want you to come in and since you have this, you've written this book on the subject and so on, I want you to come in and run it. And I took a rather deep breath at this, and since I left my wife in Canberra building a house, this is the house we're sitting in at the
right.
And so I called her up, and I stayed eventually for about 6 months in Houston, and running this laboratory, and it was one of the most difficult periods of my life because it took every bit of experience and skill I had to get the thing running and get the answers out, which had to be done in. For example, we got the first sample in our hands. We had a press conference 4 hours later, which we had to produce results at. So it was pretty rough time.
Yes, you were on your mettle there.
It was, you were right, and the searchlight was right on you.
Yes, and you had to be right.
And you had to be right, yes. Mm. Yes.
Can you describe what it was like in the lunar lab?
Well, it was quite strange because it was, of course, isolated behind quarantine barriers. And so when you went in, you had to get out of all your clothes and change into... into a sort of what looked like a surgical suit. And then the samples themselves were protected in behind so-called biological cabinets where one used rubber gloves and so on to... and these cabinets were held with a positive pressure of nitrogen. And...
About how much pressure was there?
I've forgotten. It was just enough to... Anyway, and we did all analyses through these cabinets, and so all the equipment you had to handle through rubber gloves into these biological cabinets, and including doing these chemical analyses. So just technically, it was quite difficult to handle this material, particularly because the lunar samples were so had all this static charge on them, so it made it very difficult to handle powders.
So being very dry, the nitrogen
didn't
affect its
properties. Yes.
Were there any changes from Apollo 11 to Apollo 17 in the way they analysed the
They finally gave up the quarantine procedures about Apollo 14, and... although the general perception of the people working in the laboratory was that the quarantine procedures were really unnecessary because the prospect of the moon having anything harmful or biologically harmful on it was very remote. Of course, you can't be totally certain. But the real problem was that the quarantine had been breached when they landed the... in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and they opened the hatch and got the astronauts out and they were covered in dust. And of course, this immediately.
And they brushed themselves down.
And then they walked them across the deck of the aircraft carrier, and then they put them in this caravan and took them off to Houston. But already at that point, the Earth's surface had been exposed to lunar material. Yeah. So, you know, if the Pacific Ocean turned bright green or something, we would have. So we felt the quarantine procedures in Houston were much more of a public relations exercise than anything of any scientific value.
Dr. Taylor, now 25 years on, and you've had some time to think about all this, how do you see the Apollo missions and what we found from the lunar samples? How do you see this leading us on into the future?
Well, you know, I sometimes think that when you've spent most of your life working on some subject, you should eventually come to some sort of conclusions about it. And I've been struck by what amounts to the role of chance in all these matters. The origin of the moon was very much a chance event, because if the object had hit the Earth, it hit at a different angle, we wouldn't have the moon. It turns out that the conditions under which the collision must have occurred, there had to be just the right angle and the right velocity and the right mass of the impactor. And although there are some substantial pluses and minuses in these, nevertheless, if the object had hit head-on into the Earth, we would not have formed the moon. And, of course, it might have missed altogether. And then when you come a bit closer you find, for example, the event that wiped out the dinosaurs and wiped out about 70 or 80% of the species in the Earth at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary 65 million years ago was due to the chance impact of an asteroid. If the asteroid had missed, we would not be sitting here discussing this. There would be probably some dinosaur derivatives having this conversation.
That could still happen yet.
And it could happen, of course. So this puts a chance premium on human life, human development. But even when you look at the solar system and the fact that we have a 24-hour rotation of the Earth is probably a consequence of this big collision, the early collision, that is, the one that formed the moon. The tilt of the Earth, which gives us the seasons, so we're now moving into winter in Australia, is a consequence of the fact the Earth is tilted at 24 degrees. And that is almost certainly a consequence of the moon forming collision. Venus is in contrast, is rotating very slowly backwards and is more or less has very little tilt on it. Mars is again turning at about 24 hours and has about a 25 degree tilt, although Mars wobbles about quite a bit. Whereas the Earth apparently is locked into this 24 tilt by the stabilizing influence of the Moon. So there are all these sorts of chance events. It turns out, in fact, when you look at formation of the giant planets, it turns out Jupiter is really quite difficult to form. The timing has to be really quite very fine timing is required to form a planet like Jupiter. If you don't have a big planet like that out there to intercept most of the comets and meteorites coming in, or asteroids, we would have a much higher bombardment rate. So it just seemed to me there are so many chance events that involve the formation of the solar system and the formation of the Earth that it's very unlikely that there will be clones of the Earth formed anywhere else. Even in the solar system, Venus is the closest thing we have to the Earth, and that resembles the Earth in the way that Dr. Jekyll resembled Mr. Hyde. You know, a very bad place to be with a 470 degree centigrade surface and a thick carbon dioxide atmosphere, for example.
With sulfuric acid droplets.
That's right, with a cloud of clouds of sulfuric acid droplets. So even Venus and the Earth, which are probably very similar in mass and probably in composition, turn out so differently as a result of these chance events that it seems to me that the prospect of finding life elsewhere in the way that we know it on a planet like the Earth is remote. And the sort of philosophical conclusion of this is we really ought to take much better care of ourselves than we do, because You know, when you turn the television on every night, you see the most terrible things going on, and if people only realize that they were probably unique in the universe, they may well behave somewhat better than they do.